Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. Have you ever wondered why superhero comics and movies are so popular with both adults and children? Well, it's because we all harbour a secret hankering to be one. Well, who wouldn't want to have an array of amazing Amazonian superpowers to call upon? The problem is that the only place we can find them is in comics and movies, right? Well, actually, no, because according to Dean Radin, the chief scientist of Noetic Sciences and author of the book Real Magic, the book we're going to discuss today is not just an exhilarating read, it's the definitive user's manual for superheroes. Joseph Selby is the author of The Physics of God, How the Deepest Theories of Science Explain Religion, and How the Deepest Truths of Religion Explain Science. A dedicated queer meditator for nearly 50 years, he's taught yoga and meditation throughout the US and Europe and has helped hundreds of people awaken to their own spiritual potentials. He's a founding member of Ananda, a worldwide spiritual movement inspired by Paramahansa Yogananda, and he joins me now to discuss his latest book, Break Through the Limits of the Brain, which not only connects the dots between the discoveries of neuroscience and the meditation-born spiritual experience, but also provides proven, practical exercises to help you achieve your superconscious potentials. Joseph Selby, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. So we're hearing it more and more these days that we are so much more than we know. And your latest book, Break Through the Limits of the Brain, underscores that with scientific support for the existence of a subtle, non-local reality that suggests we exist simultaneously in two realities. And also that our thoughts, emotions, memories, and life force originate non-locally. So tell me more about this.
Well, I think the heart of where science and spirituality intersect is in this concept of non-locality, that there is a realm that physics acknowledges not only does exist, but must exist to explain the way the physical universe works. But this other reality is what is called non-local reality, because it doesn't behave in exactly the same way as our local reality does. So in our local reality, we have certain laws that are affected by distance. So for example, the strength of a magnet tails off dramatically the farther away any metal object is from its magnetic center. And so you can say that's affected by distance, but non-locality has laws that aren't affected by distance because there is no distance in non-locality. There is no space in non-locality. It's very challenging for us to visualize what that could possibly be. But at the same time, physics is very solidly committed. And in fact, in some thinkers say that without this non-local reality, you could not have quantum physics. You just can't have one without the other. And this is really speaking to the same spiritual truths that are put forward by saints and sages and mystics, that we simultaneously inhabit two realities. They're different. One is the physical world that is revealed to us by the senses. The other is a world that we experience subjectively, and that other world is the world from which our thoughts, our emotions, our memories, our mind, as opposed to the brain, actually originates. So the brain coordinates sensory data and also sends commands to the motor parts of the body so that we move our muscles, we walk, we talk. But when we think, we're using our mind. We are more in that non-local reality than we are in the local reality that is our physical body. But the two work together seamlessly. And this concept exists in spiritual teachings in the form of the subtle body, the energy body, the astral body, which you find in nearly every experiential spiritual tradition around the world and throughout the ages, that we are so much more than we know. We are, in fact, these luminous beings that exist beyond the physical body, and even more than that, that we are inherently divine. We are children of the divine, and therefore we are heirs to every aspect of the divine. We just don't know it. We don't perceive it all the time because we tend to be caught up in what our neural circuits that we formed in the brain are keeping us constantly aware of, which is the physical body rather than the subtle.
So the brain is the machine that runs the body, maybe a receiver that receives instructions from the other reality, perhaps? Certainly, yes. if that's where our thoughts are. So tell me what happens when, if my thoughts are there, if my emotions are there, my memories too, then how is it that I don't know what else is there?
Well, you know it in one sense because you experience it all the time. You know you have thoughts. Nobody could talk you out of the notion that you think and that you feel and that you have memories. But the reason why it's confusingly difficult to separate the notion that there's a physical body and an astral body or an energy body is that they are occurring simultaneously. You use the phrase, you know, my thoughts are out there and my feelings are out there, but they're not. They're right here where you are. And that's what confounds the mind. The mind wants to say, well, it's either here or there. It's either, you know, this kind of reality or that kind of reality, but they exist simultaneously. Mm. And so we have all these subjective experiences that are, even though we call them subjective, science that likes objective realities is a little bit dismissive about the actual reality of subjective experience. You know, they say, well, it's fuzzy and it's different from different people, but that doesn't deny the fact that it's very much a major part of who we are. If we didn't have our thoughts, if we didn't have our feelings, if we didn't have our memories, what exactly would be left? You know, it's difficult to conceive.
Well, many people face that, don't they? They don't have their memories.
Yeah. So extreme brain damage can eliminate memories because that intricate relationship between brain and mind, between non-local brain and, or excuse me, local brain and non-local mind is complex. I describe it in my book as you have neural circuits that act like preset buttons on a radio. So if you have a radio set up and it is programmed to give you the stations that you tend to listen to most often, all you have to do is press a button and you're listening to that radio station. So we have circuits in our brain that effectively stimulate trains of thought or trains of memory or the experience of emotions that happen automatically when different stimuli comes. So the stimulus is sensory. So let's say you have a, you hear a song. That song can be the trigger of a neural circuit that then gets you thinking about what you experienced the last time you listened to that song, or the feelings you have about that song. So you have both things happening simultaneously. You have a local experience triggering a non-local experience. And then, as you said yourself, you can have non-local decisions that tell the physical body what to do. So it's a seamless, intricate, amazing connection between the two, but very much a real one.
I can understand entanglement. I can understand a lot of things. What I can't understand is if you know, there's so much that we can access, if we can get beyond the limits of the brain, there's so much, you know, and this is what your book is all about. There's so much more that we can access, a super consciousness. What happens when, in cases of, when, you know, someone has a heart transplant and we hear about them having the likes and the dislikes of the other person's heart, or maybe even a memory? You know, what is happening there? Is that entanglement, or is that something else entirely?
Well, I think it speaks to entanglement, whether it, you know, entanglement is a specific phenomenon. The more general phenomenon is when you have coherent and decoherent states of matter. So when things are entangled, they're in a coherent state. So that means they exist more, you know, specifically in the energy world of non-locality, and they haven't taken a specific physical form yet in the physical world. And so they haven't decohered. They haven't lost that deeper connection that they have in non-locality yet, because they haven't been observed. So matter in general can be in coherent states that aren't necessarily entangled. You can have multiple, even thousands of molecules that are in coherent states. We see this in photosynthesis, that the amazing efficiency of photosynthesis is because the chlorophyll molecules remain in a entangled, coherent state, and they can pass the energy on from the sun to other parts of the mechanism for storing solar energy in plants in a very efficient manner. And so there are states where they're decoherent, essentially in an energy form, and then they become less coherent and finally decoherent when they cease doing that channeling of the sun's energy. So entanglement is one expression of coherent, coherent states. So we can be in our processes more coherent or less coherent. And I think that is the answer to how you could get a heart transplant, and it would come with the memories or the feelings, or as you say, the likes and dislikes of another person. It's because it becomes decoherent when it's in your physical body and you lose those connections, but it can open up, become coherent, make its own connection to its own memories, its own feelings. This may sound completely bizarre, but it's no more bizarre than saying that we have those memories to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. It is perhaps the most it's perhaps the least bizarre explanation for how those memories can come, those feelings can come with a heart transplant. So everything, I guess that was a long-winded way of saying that every aspect of physical reality can have a connection to the non-local, purely energetic expression of reality, that they are linked. inextricably.
Why does my brain have limits?
Well, it does and it doesn't. So the title is a bit of, not absolutely certain that your brain has limits, but what is the reality for most of us is that we have used the brain to create limits. When we were children, we had to start forming neural circuits to support our ability to, you know, first crawl, move our arms and legs, to then walk, to learn to talk, to hear and understand spoken language. All of these things we weren't preset to do. Human infants are surprisingly unable to do almost anything that is of a voluntary nature. And so we have to build all those circuits in order to support our ability to do that. And if we hadn't built the circuits to walk when we were infants, every morning when we wake up, we'd be toddlers. It's a very, very complex process to walk. It involves thousands of signals going to hundreds of muscles in a coordinated fashion. And we do it every day without thinking because it is automatic. Well, the programming that we did, the wiring of the brain that we did by creating all these circuits, neural circuits, is not limited to physical activity. We also have created neural circuits that support emotional reactions, that trigger trains of thought, and that keep us involved. This is especially where the wiring starts to become a limitation, is that we do thousands, millions of these circuits so that on our ordinary waking day, we are only aware of things that are happening from sensory experience, triggering the thoughts that are connected to sensory experience. And I liken this to being like a fireworks show, because one neural circuit will trigger another neural circuit, which will trigger another neural circuit. And so we're constantly in this reactive mode that is totally focused on the senses and the world that the senses reveal to us. So this is what creates the limit of the brain. It's self-created, it's inadvertently self-created, but we have rendered ourselves neurally blind to anything except those specific actions and reactions that we've established neural circuits for most of our life. There are many cases, however, when in which young children are aware of more subtle realities. Mm. Young children see angels. They have astral awareness, and they get talked out of it, or as is often the case with psychics, they work out a very confusing relationship to it that they only realize they see things that other people don't. When they're 4 or 5 or 6 or later, they start talking about things and adults start giving them very strange reactions. And then they eventually learn that they are perceiving subtle realities that nobody else around them perceives. So that awareness is something we lose, but we never lose the innate ability to reclaim it. So that's why we have to break through the limits. We have to break through the limits of our own wiring and regain that awareness. So meditation is a big key to that. I can talk about it more in depth, but essentially, meditation doesn't give you anything. Meditation gives you access to everything. It gives you access to everything subtle that your senses don't reveal. Near-death experiencers instantly gain access to realms beyond the physical. And then when they come back, they feel like they had been in the real world and they came back to the fake world of three-dimensional reality that is to them plainly a construct of their mind, a construct of their senses that they can perceive and they can work within, but they always have this deep-seated sense of its unreality because what they experienced during their near-death experiences was much more real, much truer to their heart and mind than what we tend to perceive. So the challenge for us is to break through that self-imposed limitation.
Well, what I don't understand, if you talk about the larger part of ourselves, most of us, what we think of as ourselves is not, doesn't exist. It's non-local. If that is so, and if what I think of as me, the physical me, is a hologram, what is the purpose of this? Why? Why would I do this? Why would I split part of myself off from what I really am to live a life that is very diminished?
Well, the answer that I can give you, I can't say that I have directly experienced it with such a degree of depth that I can be certain, but I can give you the answer that most satisfies my mind and my heart, which is that we're children of God who are returning to our awareness in God, and that this process takes place through many, many incarnations. Some of those incarnations go back to us being crystals, and that it's hard to imagine what the beginning and end of a lifespan of a crystal would be, but nonetheless, the thought is that crystals are more organized matter than any other form of matter. They're in a crystalline lattice where everything is lined up, and those crystals take on different abilities. They become good at conducting things. They become translucent. Mm. And what I have read is that the soul that is only able to perceive a very small bit of itself at that point is nonetheless powerful enough to organize the matter around it and to make it form into a crystal. And that gradually those life forms become more complicated. We become plants, we become animals, and finally we become man or woman or people as we know it. But that the learning experience goes on. And the main thing about the learning experience is to be more and more aware of what we truly are. And that takes a lot of experimentation, especially when we become people, because there's a whole range of things we can do to figure out who we are and what we can do. And there's a whole range of mistakes we can make in figuring that out. But that gradually, inevitably, we're going to learn more and more about what we truly are.
Well, if we do not break through the limits of the brain, if we do not access that larger part of ourselves, that greater reality, would you say, wow, that's a missed opportunity,
Well, everybody gets to make that choice. I would personally think it's a great missed opportunity. If you are interested and you see the possibility, I would really say, I would really encourage people to take it, to experiment with meditation, to experiment with directly experiencing realities that are beyond what the senses alone can tell you, because it's wonderful. It isn't just another reality that is equal to our own. It's another reality that is deeper, that is more joyful, that is a truer source of happiness, a truer source of feeling loved and being able to therefore then give love, that the experience more than pays for the time and energy it takes to access it.
But you've been doing it for 50 years. The experience is worth that 50 years work?
I didn't have to wait 50 years to experience it. If I had, I honestly, knowing myself, doubt if I would still be meditating. So there were instant payoffs in meditation. There were longer term payoffs. And now, as I not only have done it for 50 years, as I have gone through the arc of a lifetime, I more and more appreciate what it's done for me and the day-to-day state of mind and heart that I have as a result of it. I would not trade it for anything. But I would have said that same thing truly 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I wouldn't have traded it. It just gets better, but it's still highly expansive and life-changing.
Meditation has gone mainstream, we all, I think, even if we don't practice meditation, are very aware of the science and how, you know, what the benefits are physically and in many ways, for depression, you know, for changing brain states, for changing all kinds of things that maybe we're not happy with. The key, I think, for many people is being able to meditate successfully. And this is something that I've struggled with for a long time. And we will go into this more in the second half. We're going to take a short break now. But, I think so many people really want the benefits of meditation, but find it very, very hard to meditate. Anyway, we'll come back to that. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with author Joseph Selby about his latest book, Breakthrough the Limits of the Brain, Neuroscience, Inspiration, and Practices to Transform Your Life. After the break, how to rewire your brain to create new habits and the Hong Sao technique of concentration. We'll be back with more in a few moments.
OM Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. OM Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, OM Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an OM Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on OM Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive OM Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. OM Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
If I could be you, and you could be me for just 1 hour. If we could find a way to get inside each other's minds. Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Well, before you abuse, criticize, and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes.
Welcome back. Joseph Selby, it seems that saints, sages, near-death experiencers, and meditators get to experience this greater reality. And if we're none of those, we don't, which, you know, is very upsetting. What can one do if one really finds it very, very difficult to meditate, you know, to experience that greater reality? I feel like sometimes I'm, you know, sitting on the other side of a window watching all these people who can do this wonderful thing that I just can't do.
Well, it's an excellent question and one that is often asked, and I've often been asked. So let me start by saying it is difficult. 50 years on, I can't immediately make my mind stop thinking about things. I have learned techniques. I have learned approaches with just using my own mind to get my mind to you know, quiet down. But it's not as if, even after 50 years of meditation, I can immediately become perfectly still and my mind becomes crystal focused and I, you know, go beyond the brain into this higher awareness on command. If I work at it and if I have, you know, a good amount of time to do it, I can be much more successful than I was by a long shot than I was when I first began. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's like many things. You know, if you play a sport, if you're a tennis player, you don't play well every time you go play tennis. You certainly didn't play tennis well the first time you started to play it. Everything we do in life requires some degree of practice and commitment to it to get better. So all that said, tennis kept you going if you were a tennis player because there was a spark of fun in it, even though you hit it into the net the first 50 times you hit the ball. There was something that drew you and kept you going until you could become a better tennis player. So for people who haven't established a strong meditation practice, but who do practice, I'm just about willing to admit that there were some experiences they had that they really liked, and it kept them coming back. That there's a feel for something there that is very real. So if you haven't started meditating yet, I would encourage you to do so, because I know if you do it a little while, that can vary. Some people are very lucky. They have a wonderful experience first time they sit down. Other people, you know, their mind just keeps galloping away, their body fidgets. They are wondering why on earth they're doing this, wasting this 5 minutes or 10 minutes of their life when it never works. For them, I would say, use a technique. The simple mindfulness technique can be effective, but there are techniques that can help you more than that simple technique. And one of which is one I teach in the book, Breakthrough the Limits of the Brain. And it's something I've taught 100 times at least in classes, et cetera, around the world that I've taught. But the essence of the Hunza technique is that it takes the predilection of the mind to want to think about something and gives it something specific to think about. And that is the breath. So the Hung Sa technique in its essence is watching the breath, but as the breath comes in, mentally saying the word Hung. And when the breath goes out, mentally say the word Sa. So Hung Sa, Hung Sa. Hung on the inhalation, Sa on the exhalation. So you have a focus. And as you do the technique, there are ways to bring your point of attention right to the point between the eyebrows, which is the seat of concentration for your subtle body. And it's also where we tend to concentrate naturally when we are thinking about things. You see people, you know, frown, and they're right there. They're thinking about something that's going on. It's a natural point of focus for the physical body and for the subtle body we've been talking about. So you combine that, try to bring your attention to this point, and then just watch the breath saying Hung and Sa. And I think you will find if you've had trouble getting your mind to ever calm down, that this will help you do that. It'll be more effective at doing it. So techniques are good. Commitment is good. Once you've finished doing the Hung Saw technique, and it can be 5 minutes, it can be 10 minutes, it can be 15 minutes, then stay relaxed. You know, take advantage of the calmness and the positive feelings that it gave you. Just take enough time to kind of absorb them before you dash off to the next thing in your life.
Is that enough for me to access that greater reality and really develop super consciousness? Or is there more?
I think it's important to understand that your regular consciousness, that is, I'll define it this way, as being your awareness focused through the senses, is a part of super consciousness. It is just a constricted part of super consciousness. So in a way, bear with me here, you're always using your superconscious. You're always using your innate consciousness, which is infinite, but you're just choosing to dial it way down to conscious awareness. So as soon as your conscious awareness becomes less of a focus, which it does when you close your eyes and still the body and focus the mind, you are immediately becoming more super conscious. You're immediately breaking through the limits of the brain that keep us conscious, keep us involved, keep us delighted in the fireworks show of the interconnected neural circuits that, you know, love to stimulate each other. As soon as we can pull back from that a little bit, we are automatically super conscious. So it doesn't take, it's not like an amazing breakthrough experience that is all encompassing. It changes by degree. Mm. We become more and more aware of our subtle self. And pretty much everyone has had some degree of superconscious experience, even if they're largely wired for conscious experience. So it might have just been that moment at the seaside when you were just listening to the crash of surf, your thoughts faded away from anything that was pressing or emotionally disturbing, and you just felt the wonder and beauty of being there. That feeling, even if the perception is still conscious, the feeling is super conscious. And everybody has had intuition where a thought comes to you like just seemingly out of the blue because you hadn't done a typical step-by-step rational process to have that thought, but it comes to you. And it's not only does it come like as if some random chance, but it fits something you were concerned about or wanted to know about or wanted an answer to. A lot of times personal guidance is all about following those subtle intuitive thoughts of what we should do next or how to deal with a situation, perhaps a trying situation. So we have, you know, perceptual intuition, if you will. We have thought intuition. We have feelings that are powerful and powerfully positive feelings that, you know, open our heart to loving somebody else or to being helpful to somebody else at a time when they really need help. These are all part of our super conscious nature. We take them for granted because we do have this one foot in subtle reality and one foot in the physical body reality happening. But most of what we are, if you will, exists in this greater super conscious reality. So it's not as if we never experience it. It's just that meditation helps us gradually experience it more and more and more. And the deeper you go into meditation, the deeper that experience.
When you talk about, you know, having one foot in this greater reality and one foot in another reality, you often refer to it as heaven. Why heaven?
Well, I started by talking about non-locality as being one of those fundamental concepts in physics that connects to, intersects with spiritual teachings, the especially experiential spirituality teachings. Well, one of those core teachings in experiential spirituality is that when we die, we live solely in our subtle energy body, our astral body, and we leave the physical body behind. And near-death experiencers say that same thing, is that when they died, they were fully in their astral body. But they're also in the heavens. They're also in a reality that is bigger than just their astral body. They interact with other beings who are astral beings. They interact with many, many realms that they can move to by just almost by thought, that don't require travel as we understand it. And these are the heavens. The many near-death experiencers refer to them as the heavens. And this is the way the heavens are described by the saints and sages. So they fit into this concept of non-locality and in certain theories of physics, like M theory, there is a very deep intersection between those two things. So to say that we have a astral body and a subtle body, a subtle astral body, and a physical body working together means that the majority of us exists in this heavenly other realm all the time. That's why when near-death experiencers flatline, or whatever it is that is the death experience, or measuring the death experience, they're instantly there. There's no, you know, there's no travel time. As one near-death experiencer put it, it's just like you change frequencies on a dial, and the dial is flipped, and there you are in this higher frequency. But there you are simply means that you are now fully aware of it. You are always there.
Yeah.
Anyway, because of this, you know, two-sided nature of us. So that's why our one foot in is in heaven, is because that's what the heavens are. They are the subtle reality, or part of the subtle reality, that that we can tune into, and we'll go to at death.
Mm. The book offers a lot of proven practices and techniques, and you know, we talked about the concentration one, the meditation technique. One of the things that interested me is it also talks about introspection, affirmations, energization exercises. The affirmations got my attention. You know, there has been so much about affirmations, you know, in the past 30, 40 years, and many people have lost faith in them because they've been kind of, they've been hijacked to a degree, and they've become a little bit trite. Reading what you were saying about affirmations, I decided to buy the book, Yogananda's book on affirmations, and they were quite different. Do you think that, you know, we have to do affirmations in a specific way and, you know, just follow the way his are laid out, because they're very hard to memorize, some of them. And if you're reading them, then you're really not giving them, you know, 100% of your attention, are you?
Right.
So what's your thought there?
Well, let me take one step back and then come back to what specific affirmations you might want to use. I think the reason why affirmations have in fact sort of fallen into disrepute, or people, as you say, have lost faith in them, is because an expectation has been created that all you need to do is a handful of affirmations and whatever it is you're affirming will become a reality in your life. And most people discover that it doesn't become a reality in their life. And so they say, well, affirmations don't work. Well, there is a method to doing them that most people don't follow. Whatever system of affirmations you are drawn to, or wherever you have run into affirmations that you like, you will probably find, if you go deeply enough into those systems, that they need to be repeated until you believe them at deep levels, that you really need to get heart and mind together, believing whatever it is you're saying. And if it is a challenging belief for you, you need to be realistic about whether you're really ready to not believe that. You can't just magic it by saying an incantation 10 times or even 100 times. If you really believe it deeply, then you're probably going to stick with the belief that you have. Even if you emotionally don't want that belief anymore, you have to be realistic about what you do believe. So what I recommend with affirmations is that you combine the process with introspection. Look at what you do every day. Have a time in your day where you stand back from what happened in your day and ask yourself a question. So perhaps you're having trouble with feeling unsafe or easily triggered to be angry, or just everything adds to your stress. At the end of your day, when you've got 10 minutes, 15 minutes to think about it, ask yourself, well, what happened today? What threw me into not feeling safe or not feeling loved or not feeling relaxed? Just pick one of those. Don't pick all of them. But let's say we're going to pick not feeling relaxed. What is it that triggered it that made me not feel relaxed? And just get to know the response, not trying to figure out how to overcome that trigger. Just get to know what really gets you going. And if you do that for weeks, you'll begin to see a pattern. You'll begin to see that there are certain things that really make you feel stressed and take away your relaxation. And if you can boil those down to a particular thing, and maybe it is that you don't feel safe, maybe it is that you don't feel loved by others, or you don't feel supported by others. Find that pattern. Maybe there's multiple patterns, but find the one that is of particular power in your life. And then look for an affirmation that is the antidote. And use that methodically to build a new neural circuit. So what you're experiencing when you have all of those experiences is you're having neural circuits that you've already wired in your life through your life experiences that fire when certain things happen. And we all know this, you know, we talk about, well, it's like they pressed a button. And in a very real way, it is like they pressed a button. That button is a neural circuit in your brain that fires and makes you feel stressed or angry or whatever it is. So just accept that you have wired yourself in these patterns. And if you really don't want that pattern anymore, then you need to wire a new pattern. You need to be deliberate about it. And so affirmation can become a really powerful tool. Find an affirmation that may, let's say it is that you feel unsafe in this world, that you just, everything makes you feel like it's out to get you. find an affirmation that affirms your deeper divine safety. And that affirmation may just simply be, I am surrounded and loved by the infinite in all things in my life. You may not believe that. You may believe it intellectually, but not truly believe it, because on an emotional level, you're still not feeling safe. So this is going to take time to penetrate to your feelings and to your thoughts that you can really believe it. You can leaven this process with meditational experiences where you do feel relaxed and you do feel safe. Put it all together, but keep repeating that affirmation until you really believe it. And what then happens is that the situations that would have triggered you to feel unsafe will start to trigger this deeper feeling that you really are safe. Even though these things are happening, I am safe. There's nothing really that can get to me because I am beyond all these superficial things that are happening in my life. I am much more than I know. I am this subtle reality beyond the physical. And it can take weeks to months of doing a single affirmation over and over and over at specific times, whenever you can do them. But understand that you're rewiring your brain. You're doing something very specific. It's not just kind of, you know, shouting out to the void. You're actually making a new circuit in your brain, which once made is a real physical thing that will come to your rescue when that is triggered, and it will antidote the other neural circuits that you previously built, because it'll take that triggering away from them. It'll trigger that deeper, calmer self than the stressed one.
So you're saying,
I don't want to put this out as a quick panacea to everything, because it is time consuming. The bigger panacea is meditation, because it rewires your whole brain, not just specific circuits. But affirmation can be a powerful, specific tool.
So forget the, you know, sticking the post-it notes on the mirror and just repeating everything by rote while you're cleaning your teeth. You're talking about structure. You're talking about, you know, a methodology here. You're talking about, you know, actually putting some effort into it.
Yes.
And taking it deeper.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to do it, be serious about it. Otherwise, you are more or less wasting your time. I don't want to say that even an attempt is a complete waste, because it's going to leave some memory of what you were doing. There's going to be some gain in there that you might be able to remember. So I don't want to sound like if you fail, it's useless. But I do want to underscore that you get a lot more out of it if you stick with it until you really get to this point where you have rewired your brain.
Having read your book, I mean, we're almost out of time now, so we're going to have to be quick, but having read The Physics of God and also this one, do you see these as a kind of, you know, a sequel, so to speak, that this one just goes a little bit deeper, has a little bit more of the practical in it?
I did put more exercises into it than I did The Physics of God. The information really is, you could read them in any order, I think, and not find it confusing. You don't have to have started with The Physics of God and then read this. But the Breakthrough the Limits of the Brain definitely offers much more than meditation, which I do offer in The Physics, but it offers these tools of introspection and of affirmation and energization, as you say, and, you know, learning to live a more concentrated life. The more concentrated you are in all things, the faster you rewire your brain. So there's a lot of how-to in Breakthrough the Limits of the Brain.
Laying out the pathway. I think for me, you know, The Physics of God was, you know, here it is. Here's the big picture. Here's the whys and the evidence and everything else. And there's a little bit of, you know, you do talk about the meditation there, but this one is definitely laying out a pathway for people like me who do want to go deeper and have some of that greater experience. I'm afraid we're out of time now, Joseph. It always seems to go so fast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks.
So, Breakthrough the Limits of the Brain, Neuroscience, Inspiration and Practices to Transform Your Life is published by New Page Books, which is the division of Red Wheel Wiser. For more information about Joseph Selby, his books and his work, visit josephselby.com and expandinglight.org. That brings us to the end of this week's show. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'll be back at the same time next week with another edition of What Is Going On. Till then, it's goodbye from me.